Today, inside the trial which has ended with Harvey Weinstein going to prison. And coronavirus. Should we be panicking yet?
I checked my phone and my eyes just saw the word guilty and the world just stopped. It was the word I wanted to see, but it was not the word I expected.
Zoe Brock is one of more than 100 women who have accused Harvey Weinstein of sexual harassment and assault. In a New York court on Monday, Weinstein was found guilty on two counts of committing a criminal sex act and rape in the third degree.
For the first time in years, I felt lighter and hopeful and proud and this kind of slightly sad joy. It's complicated.
Zoe wasn't part of the criminal trial, but she was following closely from her home in New Zealand as the verdict came through.
I thought about Harvey in jail and how awful that must be for him and how his kids must feel. And I had to remind myself what a dreadfully awful human being he is and the things that he's done.
Weinstein was acquitted of three more charges: first-degree rape and two counts of predatory sexual assault. But for the many women who say they have suffered at his hands, like Zoe, Monday's verdict was a victory.
And I am so grateful to that jury for having the compassion and the understanding to have heard those women and to know that even if you're in a consensual relationship and no matter what you do before or after, if you say no, no means no.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, how the Harvey Weinstein trial ended in a guilty verdict. Just a warning before we start, this episode does include descriptions that some listeners may find upsetting.
When the verdict was delivered, Weinstein's lawyer says that he was in shock. He kept saying, "I'm innocent, I'm innocent."
The trial of the film producer Harvey Weinstein started on the 22nd of January.
The disgraced movie mogul hobbled into court today using a walker.
And the rapist is you!
Guardian US reporter Lauren Aratani has been covering it from the start, and she was one of hundreds of reporters at the courthouse when the verdict came through.
I was in this pit of reporters, like kind of a semicircle of cameras set up around these microphones. And that's where we were waiting for specifically Weinstein's defense team to come out and give comment on what they thought about the verdict. The defense team, you know, he has a group of about five or six lawyers, and they were kind of walking up to the microphone.
So you guys are going to have to make a choice because we have to go do some work. So you need to hear from the defense
okay.
team.
It was pretty tense because they were waiting around, and all of a sudden they all came forward to the microphone. And Gloria Allred, who is an attorney representing two of the six women who testified in the trial.
Do you want to go over there? Is that what you want to do?
And Weinstein's lawyers were saying, we're not going to speak if Gloria is going to speak. And Gloria said, well, you're trying to silence me.
You're not going to silence me again. Oh, yes, you are.
Weinstein's lawyer said, well, it's either Gloria or us. Gloria didn't move, and so they walked away.
It's no longer business as usual in the United States. This is the age of empowerment of women.
That really spoke to how tense this trial is and how tense it is trying to talk to these people.
Because women will not be silenced. Harvey Weinstein, this justice has been a long time coming, but it's finally here. And it's not the end.
Lauren, since this story broke in 2018, over 100 women have come forward with allegations of sexual assault or harassment against Harvey Weinstein. Not all of these were criminal complaints, and some had passed the statute of limitations, which means they happened too long ago to be tried in court. By the time this trial started, how many accusers were there?
There were six women testifying in this case. Two were seen as the main accusers. One is a woman named Miriam Haley. She's based in London, and she worked as a production assistant on Weinstein's show Project Runway. And she accused him of forcible oral sex in 2006. The second main accuser is someone that The Guardian isn't naming because she hasn't stated publicly whether she is comfortable being named. And she accused Weinstein of raping her in 2013. Three other women were what the court is calling prior bad acts witnesses, which means that their accusations don't merit charges of their own, but they were allowed to testify to give credit to a pattern of predatory behavior. And then the sixth woman is an actress named Annabella Scora, and her accusation and its role in the trial is a little bit more complicated. She was used to give credit to two charges of predatory sexual assault, which means that a person committed sex crimes against two or more people.
Who was prosecuting in this case?
The main prosecutor is this woman named Joan Luzzi Orban, and she actually is known for murder prosecutions. She is most known for prosecuting successfully a case where there was no body. Luzzi Orban is tough, and you could definitely see that play out in the trial. Something to note about the courtroom is that the acoustics aren't that great. The lawyers had to speak into a microphone stand, but sometimes, you know, they would be pacing around, you know, doing this show. For Joan Luzzi Orban, she didn't really need a microphone. Anything that you needed to hear, you would hear. And I think that says a lot about the type of prosecutor that she is.
And by now, many of us may be familiar with the woman defending Harvey Weinstein, a lawyer called Donna Rotuno.
Harvey has a right to a defense. Harvey has the right to a fair trial. Harvey has the right to be presumed innocent.
Can you tell me a bit more about her and how she operated during this trial?
She is a Chicago-based attorney who has built a reputation of defending people who have been accused of sexual assault. She has been going around the media circuit. Even during the trial, she had done interviews with the New York Times.
I had another question, which was whether or not you've been sexually assaulted.
I have not.
Okay.
I have not. Because I would never put myself in that position.
She's been very vocal about her criticism about the Me Too movement.
What bothers me about Me Too, it allows the court of public opinion to take over the narrative. And when you can't come out and then either correct or challenge that narrative, it puts you in a position where you're stripped of your rights.
Her stance is that women should take responsibility for their actions and their choices. So you definitely saw that coming out during her cross-examination of the witnesses. It was clear that she was trying to make a point to the jury that they should be questioning these women and their behaviors.
Lauren, you've laid out the trial for us and talked about the six women who took the stand. What did their testimonies collectively say about the behavior of Harvey Weinstein?
Their testimonies attested to this pattern of Weinstein essentially using his power. These women in the beginning believed that they could trust him up until the point where he would, for example, ask for a massage or start undressing when they were in hotel rooms with him. And so a lot of what you're seeing is Weinstein making it very clear to them the type of power that he has as one of the most powerful producers in Hollywood, and using that to essentially tell these women, hey, if you do this with me, this is what I can give to you. For one of the witnesses, she said that Weinstein held up papers and he said, these are contracts for my next three films. If you agree to have a threesome with me, I will sign these right now. And so that really displays the type of power dynamic that he really set forth for all the women.
Let's talk about one of the two main accusers who we're not naming, as she hasn't said if she wishes her name to be publicized. How did the prosecution present her at this trial?
Well, the very first questions that they asked her were about her childhood. Her family was poor, and she said that while she grew up in this town that was very small, she still had very big dreams of moving to Hollywood and becoming an actress. And so she eventually moved to LA, And that's when she met Weinstein. At a party in the Hollywood Hills, she saw her friend talking to Weinstein, you know, walked up to her friend and asked, oh, who's this? And Weinstein, she says, replied, oh, you don't know who I am? And essentially, he started listing off his resume of films. And that's when she realized how powerful this person that she was talking to was.
What happened after that? What were their interactions after that night?
So she said that the first time that Weinstein abused her was at a hotel in New York City when she had flown over from Los Angeles. And she described this moment where she realized that Weinstein was checking into the hotel, even though this was New York City and this is where he was based. And she said that he put his arm around her and took her upstairs. Weinstein took her into the bedroom, shut the door on the both of them. And she said that she tried multiple times to leave, but he kind of held the door shut. And then from there, it just escalated. Weinstein demanded that she undress. Even though she protested, he took her hands and forced her to undress. And then at that point, she says she gave up. Weinstein went into the bathroom to do something, came out, and then that's when she said that he got on top of her and they had intercourse. After, she said that when she was trying to collect herself in the bathroom, she mentioned that she saw a needle in the trash can. And she took out the needle and memorized the name that was on it. And she Googled it later and saw that it was some type of thing for erectile dysfunction. And that, she said, is when she just broke down, knowing that that had happened.
How, in this trial, did the defense jump on this portrayal and try to turn it against her?
The cross-examination of this accuser went on for 3 days. It was about 10 hours.
Facing a withering cross-examination, the aspiring actress sobbed so uncontrollably today, the judge had to end early.
It was just Donna Rotunno asking this accuser multiple questions about documented interactions they had. So emails and text messages. What Donna would do is she would bring an email onto this screen that was in front of the jury and in front of the courtroom and say, here is this email where you're telling Weinstein, I'm so happy that we met. And that was her way of trying to show the jury that this relationship that they had was consensual.
The defense argued the aspiring actress and Hollywood producer were in a consensual relationship that lasted years. Defense attorney Donna Rotunno asking, you manipulated Harvey Weinstein every time you continued to see him after each sexual encounter?
And the accuser herself had gotten to a point where she seemed to be very frustrated. She turned to the jury at one point and said, I'm not ashamed of my behavior. I don't have any excuses, but I can tell you that he's my rapist.
It sounds incredibly exposing to have your emails put up like that in front of the court anyway. But was this line of questioning also done quite aggressively?
You can kind of see how the court system is set up so that it's not like an open-ended interview where a witness can go on telling their story however they please. They can only speak within the confines of the question that is asked. And so when it came to Donna Rotunno asking this accuser questions about what these emails were about, she could only respond yes or no to some of them. And Rotunno asked the accuser, you sent him emails telling him how wonderful he was. You sent him emails thanking him. And that was just a question that she could respond yes or no to. And instead, the accuser said, it's just keeping him happy. I felt safe over email. Something that was pretty complex about their relationship is that she did say that Weinstein could be a good person. She described him as having a Jekyll and Hyde personality. He could lift you up, make you feel good about yourself. And then in private, he could be very angry when he didn't get his way.
So what the defense were trying to do, it seems, in this case, is to say that actually the power balance here did not lie necessarily with Weinstein being the one with the power, but actually these women who were using it to further their own career ambitions by sleeping with him. Is that something that they argued throughout this trial?
It was. And when it came to this accuser, Donna Rotunno specifically accused her of lying to Weinstein when she said, "You make me feel beautiful," or "I really enjoyed seeing you." She made a big show of trying to tell the jury this woman lied to Weinstein by building this relationship that was transactional because she was an actress trying to make it out in Hollywood without having any sort of romantic or sexual attraction to Weinstein. It was him that was the victim of this manipulating woman. That was the overall message that she was trying to tell the jury.
It's unbelievable, really, that you could turn the story around like that and also use what appears to be words that this woman said to protect herself against Weinstein as evidence that she's lying. At the beginning of this episode, we heard from Zoe Brock, who said that what this verdict shows is that you can be in a consensual relationship and still be raped. And in the wake of trauma, we all do complicated things. Is this what you saw play out during some of the testimonies in this trial?
For sure. And I think that that is something the prosecutors were obviously trying to equip themselves of fighting against, are these misconceptions of how rape victims and sexual assault victims behave. So one of the things that they did is they brought in a forensic psychiatrist named Barbara Zib to testify on rape myths. Barbara Zib had actually testified at the trial of Bill Cosby. And she actually pulled up a PowerPoint as if she was teaching a class on rape myths. And the PowerPoint was just titled Rape Myths. And she said, a rape myth is that victims don't communicate with perpetrators after an incident. And of course, that is the main argument that Weinstein team had in defending him. And Barbara Ziv told the jury that is not only something rape victims do, but is actually pretty much the norm because a majority of sexual assault happens between people who know each other.
And this is one of many reasons why some of these women took years to speak out about what happened to them. Is this something that Weinstein's defense team picked up on?
I mean, a big argument, and they're still arguing it even after this verdict has been ruled, is that these women are going through a regret sex where they simply regret that they had any type of physical engagement with Weinstein. And only after the Me Too movement was born out of the accusations against Weinstein is when they came out. It seemed that Weinstein's team was trying to show the jury these women were reporting in a way that was advantageous to them.
From what you've said, we can get a sense of just how complex a case like this is for a jury making this decision. Weinstein was found guilty on 2 counts, but not on 3, including the 2 most serious of predatory sexual assault. Why not?
So it seems the reason has to do with the testimony of Annabella Scora, who is an actress. All we know is that the jury could not agree on whether her testimony merited a predatory sexual assault charge, meaning that Weinstein had assaulted 2 or more women. We know that they believed that Weinstein assaulted Miriam Haley and that second main accuser, and that he did not get those predatory sexual assault charges means that there was something about her testimony that they couldn't agree on.
This trial is now over and Harvey Weinstein is facing jail time. The minimum term he can receive is 5 years, but he could spend up to 29 years in prison. When will we know his sentence?
Weinstein is set to be in prison until March 11th. When he will be sentenced. He is also under charges from the Los Angeles district attorney's office for four counts from two women. And so once this New York case wraps up, he's going to have to go to LA for court. Another thing is that his lawyers are trying to appeal this decision. And then once that's settled, then that's when we will know for sure whether the verdict stands.
The judge opened this case by telling the jury not to treat this as putting Me Too on trial. But the Weinstein story is what ignited the Me Too movement. Despite what was said, do you think this was a trial of Me Too?
I think so. The prosecution bringing forth these stories of women who say that even though they had complex relationships with Weinstein, even though they went up to the hotel rooms, that didn't change the fact that they were assaulted. That's where you see this trial being about what the Me Too movement has been trying to build, is essentially a reckoning on who has power and how common it is for people to abuse power through sexual assault. And so what the jury's verdict shows is that at least this group of people who, you know, random New Yorkers chosen to decide the fate of Harvey Weinstein, they believe that these women were assaulted. And I think that says a lot of how far the movement has come.
Lauren, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lauren and The Guardian's chief US reporter, Ed Pilkington, were in court throughout the trial. You can read all of their work at theguardian.com, where you can also listen to our previous episodes about the Harvey Weinstein case, including Anushka's full interview with Zoe Brock. Coming up, coronavirus isn't meant to be any worse than seasonal flu. So why are we so worried about it?
Too often in science podcasts, we hear voices not of the people who might be affected by new discoveries, but of those who made them. What if we flip that on its head?
My daughter's got an extra chromosome, and I would absolutely delete that. And it's not to change her, it's to change that extra chromosome that holds her back.
With our Common Threads podcast, we travelled around the country to hear people's questions, hopes, and fears when it comes to something called gene editing.
I'd say that he's very happy in his skin. The only person that has suffered because of him is me.
To have a listen, just search Common Threads on your podcast app.
Now, as coronavirus spreads rapidly around the world, it can be difficult to stay calm. But, says The Guardian's science correspondent Hannah Devlin, doing just that is key to halting the outbreak.
We're told not to panic about the threat of coronavirus. We're told that for most people, it's probably not anything worse than seasonal flu. But on the other hand, we're seeing these really drastic actions by governments. Borders being closed, people in hazmat suits, and entire cities in lockdown. And I think for a lot of people, it can be really hard to reconcile these two pictures. I think a lot of the confusion around how worried we should be about coronavirus comes down to how we think about risk, and the idea that the way we think about risk as an individual is completely different to how governments are trying to make those calculations for the whole country. As an individual, we have a personal tolerance for how risky we like to be about things, and that's just down to personality and our own circumstances. And then we also have to balance out risks against things like maybe you've been really looking forward to going on a holiday, or the sheer inconvenience of being quarantined at home for 2 weeks and having to take time off work that you might not be able to afford. Whereas a government, they're not thinking about the average person. They're not thinking about you. They're thinking about society as a whole. And that includes the most vulnerable people, old people, children with asthma, pregnant women. How's it going to affect them? Governments also have to think about the worst case scenario. A leaked UK government document on Wednesday suggested that 500,000 people could die from coronavirus if the disease were to affect 80% of the country. Now, that's not what anyone expects is going to happen, but it's possible. But I think the real risk is that when people see figures like that, that sound extremely scary, and then at the same time, they're getting advice that they shouldn't panic, people can start to distrust government and think that one of those two things is not true. And that's a really dangerous situation. The spread of coronavirus around the world is really proving to be a test of that trust between governments and citizens. We've seen this distrust most recently in Iran, where there's been a lot of scepticism about the official figures being put out on the number of people who've died and been infected with coronavirus. We've even seen the country's deputy health minister feverishly mopping his brow at a press briefing where he was reassuring everyone that Iran had the situation under control, only for him to be declared positive for the coronavirus himself the following day. In the UK, no one's questioning the official figures being put out on coronavirus, but people are worried and the way these messages are delivered really matters. So when we see the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, joking this week that he probably wouldn't go to Northern Italy at the moment, in apparent contradiction with the government's official guidelines, that sows the seeds of doubt about what the government's telling us, and it can lead to confusion and uncertainty about how closely people have to really follow what the government's telling them. When we look at how outbreaks like coronavirus spread, it's not just dependent on how the disease transmits from one person to another or what the medical treatments are available. It's also really dependent on people's behaviour. Things like whether they report when they've got symptoms, whether they follow instructions to go into quarantine. And so the question of whether this is going to be brought under control or whether it's going to spread further and further and potentially be with us indefinitely is so dependent on that relationship of trust between government and citizens.
That was Hannah Devlin. You can hear her on The Guardian's excellent Science Weekly podcast. Find it at theguardian.com. Thanks to Hannah, Lauren Aratani and Zoe Brock. Today's episode was produced by Hannah Moore and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow, but before I go, thank you to everyone who has reviewed the podcast recently. We really love hearing from you, whatever you think, but especially if you say something nice.